Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is the United States the only nation in the world that had to fight a civil war in order to abolish slavery? And what role did fanatics play in inciting conflict? As my guest today will tell us, deep cultural divisions between North and South, along with the resentments they bred, were present decades before the run-up to the war and were fueled by radical agitators on both sides. The new book by historian and author Thomas Fleming is called A Disease of the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it. I was just saying how much I like the title of your show.
Well, thank you.
That's what I started to do when I found out, when I first heard that phrase, a disease of the public mind. I started to think.
Yeah, talk about the phrase, because it may not be familiar to people, but it turns out to be the perfect description of what you're talking about here.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's fallen out of style long, long ago. It was first uttered by a president of the United States, James Buchanan. He was assessing the uproar caused by John Brown when he raided Harper's Ferry, hoping to get his hands on 100,000 rifles and start a race war in the South. And he said, "There's nothing that can be done. It's a disease of the public mind." And a year later, when the South was seceding, again, he said in a message to Congress, "There's nothing that can be done. It's a disease of the public mind." And what he meant was the public mind is, I had to do a lot of investigation to find out what the public mind meant, because that's another phrase that sort of dropped out. And the public mind is a way of seeing the real world around us. It isn't public opinion. That changes, you know, every 2 days. But the public mind is the basic faiths or the basic opinions that we consider part of the realities of our lives. And this is what Buchanan believed had become distorted in the course of the feud that had been going on between the North and the South for a long time.
It's interesting that we as Americans today tend to be proud of the Civil War to the extent that it ended slavery, but every other former slaveholding nation managed to achieve that outcome without war.
Right. Chris, I was shocked to discover, I always thought it was, it's almost trivial to get into the numbers, but it isn't really. The standard casualty rate has been 600,000 dead. Mm-hmm. But recent research by very good statistically minded historians have raised that to a probable 850,000, and I say it's almost certainly a million. Mm-hmm. And so that's a million men dead in a population of 31 million. If we had a war like this today, we'd have 10 million dead. Can you imagine the tidal wave of grief that would wash over our world? This is what the Civil War meant to the people who lived through it.
So you write here about the longstanding economic and also cultural divisions between slaveholding and free states, and this was not something that suddenly became a problem in the mid-19th century.
No. In fact, what really surprised me was it goes back before there was an argument about slavery. The New England states had a definite opinion of themselves, which was very high. They felt they started the revolution and they should be running the country. But who, of course, got elected? The first president, George Washington. And then they were somewhat mollified when John Adams was elected. But then came Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe. That's two terms each of Southern presidents, and the New Englanders did not like this at all. They expressed their outrage when Jefferson bought Louisiana, a third of the nation between the Mississippi and the Rocky Mountains. He bought it from France, and when you would think everybody would be wildly enthusiastic, but in New England they said, "This reduces us to a minority in this country. That will be settled mostly by Southerners." And they did everything in their power to oppose this purchase. And next came a a decision by Jefferson to avoid a war with England, he declared an embargo on all trade with Europe. And again, New England was wrecked by this thing. It was this was literally wrecked. Not only did they hate it, but they had 40,000 sailors rioting in their ports, and merchants went bankrupt by the dozen because they carried most of the cargo. And that's when they started to say, these Southerners are enemies. They're our enemies. They're not our friends. And they're not our fellow Americans. And then as this hostility built up throughout the War of 1812, and they started talking about seceding from the Union. They came very close to having a convention in Hartford in 1814 that would have voted to secede from the Union. But the war ended before they could get to the point of taking a vote. Now the hatred of the South was very much alive in their minds, and they started to look around for a reason to hate the South besides sheer jealousy, and they found it in slavery. That was the South's moral flaw, and they started objecting every time a state tried to enter the Union from the Louisiana Territory if they tolerated slavery. And this was the beginning of this terrific feud between the two sections.
Is it safe to say that by the middle of the 19th century, the two halves of this country had already been operating in some ways like two separate countries?
To some extent. Not completely, though. I mean, they still got together in Congress and so forth, and they talked sometimes fairly seriously about this problem. Now, there's another aspect of this, Chris, that I think I definitely should mention, and you probably have noticed it. You saw it in the book. I think it's the most original thing I found in explaining this terrible tragedy of the Civil War, a combination tragedy and triumph, as you say. And this was, I call it, Thomas Jefferson's nightmare. This began right after Jefferson became president, when a French diplomat asked him if he would support the idea of a French army invading Santo Domingo, which was once a French possession, at least half of the island was. We now call it Haiti. And Jefferson said, yes, I will support you. We'll get rid of that black dictator who's running the country. He was talking about Toussaint Louverture, a very gifted slave, an ex-slave, rather, who was running the half of the island that was spoke French. Mm-hmm. And everything went wrong with the scheme. The French army collapsed of yellow fever after about a year, but with the terrible, murderous combat on both sides. And they had to withdraw from the island. And the only man left standing was this Haitian general, Jean-Jacques Dessalines. And by this time, he and everybody in his army was so enraged at the French that they marched across the island and they killed every white French man, woman, and child. And when that news reached Thomas Jefferson, that was the beginning of his nightmare, the nightmare of a race war. And what was really tragic about it, the terrible thing that happened, there's no doubt about that, it also then infected the public mind of the South. So that 50 years later, when John Brown raided Harper's Ferry and Robert E. Lee, who captured him with the help of a company of Marines, when Robert E. Lee went to his headquarters, Brown's headquarters, and found correspondence from six rich Northerners who had backed Brown in this crazy scheme, everybody who mattered in the South, and not a few of them, said this in newspapers and sermons. They said they want to inflict another Santo Domingo on us. So this is 55 or 6 years later. That's what they thought. So that this, if that isn't proof that this had become a disease in the Southern mind, the idea of freeing all these slaves, which the North was now demanding, they called themselves abolitionists, it collided head-on with this dread of a race war.
Jefferson, of course, is an interesting figure to consider, you know, in so many different ways. But can you talk about his, his ideas about the sort of inherent hierarchy of human beings according to race?
Yes, I'll be happy to, because I wrote a biography of Jefferson many years ago, and I've been interested in him all my life. I really have, and he's a man who, once he got an idea that he thought was the answer to a question he was asking himself, he seldom changed it. And while he hated slavery, in the Declaration of Independence, he blasted the English for inflicting slavery on the Americans and revealed his detestation of the whole idea of slavery. But he did not think, and this was, again, Jefferson was playing the scientist, he did not think blacks and whites were equal. He thought blacks were inferior in intelligence and many other ways. He thought they were childish in their emotions. He really had a catalog of flaws. And he even didn't like their color. It was monotonous, this black monotony, he called it. And he put all of these thoughts in a book called Notes on Virginia, which he originally wrote for some friends in France. But he then agreed to let them publish it in France as a book, and it was translated into English, and it was soon published in England and then in the United States. And this became one of the most quoted books of the 19th century. The race superiority argument, the people in the South used it again and again to tell, well, we're superior, the white race is superior. Thomas Jefferson said so. And also, Jefferson thought that blacks, aside from the terrible nightmare that happened in Haiti, he thought that the whole idea of slavery caused so much resentment that blacks and whites simply could not live together. It was just a disastrous series of conclusions he drew, which I wound up, as I call it in my first chapter where I introduced Jefferson in the book, he was, I call him slavery's greatest foe and unintended friend. And he was the Declaration of Independence was what basically destroyed slavery in America after this terrible war. And Abraham Lincoln said as much in his Gettysburg Address. And so Jefferson is an incredibly paradoxical man. You can love him for so many things he did, his brilliance as an architect and so forth. But as a politician, he simply didn't seem to think ahead and see the consequences of his actions.
How did the presence of slaves or the absence of slaves cause the economies of the North and South to develop in different ways?
The economy of the North was basically oriented towards small farms but I think first we ought to say, though, that there were very few, a minority of slaves in the North. Mm-hmm. Not a tiny minority. Slaves were about 15% in the state of New York and about 12 or 14% in New Jersey. So there were in some of the states of the North, but as you went further north, Massachusetts had 4 or 5%. And so it wasn't difficult to gradually abolish slavery in these states. New York simply said every slave born after such and such a date would be free. And that solved the problem. But in the South, the number of slaves kept multiplying because of the profitability of raising cotton.
Let me jump in for just a second here, Tom. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is historian and author Thomas Fleming. We're talking about his new book, A Disease of the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Thomas Fleming, whose new book is called A Disease of the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Join the conversation by emailing think at KERA.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Tom, before the break, you were talking about the fact that as the Southern economy moved widely into growing cotton, it sort of changed the calculus for slavery and the need for slaves to continue working those plantations.
Yes. Well, the number of slaves just grew so rapidly because slavery was very profitable. Mm-hmm. And so there was an internal slave trade. Virginians and the people in the northern tier of the slave states was selling this slaves to the south, where most of the cotton was being raised. And this was a very unpleasant thing. Families were broken up and so forth. And there was a lot of pain involved in slavery. There's no doubt about it. I would be the last person in the world to try to justify it or even portray it as a benevolent institution or in any way, shape, or form. But nonetheless, this was, you might say, the South's fate, that they inherited this tradition of raising these crops, and they had the workforce, the slaves. They had, by the time the Revolution ended, there were many, many more slaves in the South than there were in the North. And but what I liked about to talk about, though, is how many Southerners early on tried to, they talked about getting rid of slavery, and they wanted to do something about it. And my most surprising discovery in this, Chris, is George Washington. Hmm. Now, everybody knows, I think, that he was a slave owner, but very few people know how many things he did to begin the movement towards eliminating slavery. And I would love to chat a little bit about that if you're interested in it.
Absolutely. And I know one of the things he did was he emancipated his own slaves upon his death. Is that right?
He what? Excuse me?
Did Washington emancipate his own slaves upon his death?
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. That was the last act of his life, you might say. He in his will, he specified that the 123 slaves he owned at Mount Vernon, there was about another 100 that his wife Martha owned, and he had no control over them. But the 123 he owned, he freed. But not only that, Chris, he gave specific instructions for each man and woman. He wanted them taught to read and write, and he wanted them trained in a skill of some sort so they could make an honest living. Now, this was in 1799, when most Southerners didn't think, partly because of Thomas Jefferson's influence, didn't think that blacks could be educated this way. And here was Washington. He paid no attention to what Thomas Jefferson's opinions about almost anything. They did not get along, to
right.
put it mildly. And here he was telling everybody, this is what I want, and I want it. He gave specific instructions to his surviving relatives. Under no circumstances can any one of these slaves be sold while this will is being processed in the courts and so forth and so forth. It was just a very striking example of his determination to do something about this. But before this, way back, he started to do things that have been totally forgotten. In 1775, he became the commander-in-chief of what became the Continental Army, the American Army. And they called it the Continental because they were trying to use some pretext to unite these 13 very separate colonies. And all kinds of black men who had fought at Bunker Hill and at Lexington and Concord came to him and said, "We want to join your army, General," and so forth. "We want to fight for America's independence." Most of them were free men. Hmm. And Washington said, "If these men want to fight, they'll be in my army." And some Southern congressman objected, but nobody could stop him. And he started putting slaves into the ranks, ex-slaves, free blacks, into the ranks. Soon there was an entire black regiment from Rhode Island that came forward. And they, too, joined the army. And by the end of the American Revolution, one in every seven men in the ranks of the American army was black. I think this is one of the most striking examples of what Washington was willing and eager to do. And there's a very good reason for it, too, Chris. The man who awakened his sense of responsibility for slavery was the Marquis de Lafayette, the idealistic young French volunteer that Washington liked a great deal, and he liked Washington. In fact, Washington thought of him as sort of an adopted son. He didn't have any children, Washington didn't. But Lafayette absolutely staggered his adopted father one day when he said, if I had known that I was going to form or to help found the Republic of Slavery, I never would have volunteered my sword to fight for America's freedom. And these words really struck home to Washington, and that's when he started to do things like accept people in the Continental Army, and then he began treating his slaves at Mount Vernon as if they were semi-free, at least. He absolutely refused to break up a marriage under any circumstances. He would not sell a wife or a husband. And he gave them responsibilities. He made several of them overseers. These were talented men. You know, they knew they had leadership ability. He made them overseers of some of Mount Vernon's farms. And when they did a good job, he rewarded them. And one day he advertised for a painter, and he said to paint something in Mount Vernon. You know, he said, "I don't care whether he comes from the north or the south, or from Europe or from Africa." He really was firmly convinced that America had to solve this problem, otherwise it would destroy America's unity, and that it was the crucial thing, as Washington saw it. The unity of the country. If we split up, if the South split up into a separate country, then part of them would probably separate, and in the North there'd be secessions, and the next thing you know, we'd be like Europe, and all of these different states would be fighting vicious wars with each other. He saw all this, and he insisted again and again that this was what we had to do, and he wrote a farewell address in which he said, "The thing you must value above all else is your unity and the bond of fraternal affection that unites us." That's fraternal affection. I love that phrase. That's brotherhood. He was talking about all the Southerners and Northerners are brothers. We're American brothers and sisters, too, of course. And it was such a profound truth, and he believed it passionately. And yet the events and the disagreements that we've been discussing slowly eroded this sense of brotherhood between the two parts of the country. But Lincoln did everything in his power to try to revive Washington's message. When he wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln gave one of the pens that he signed this great document with, he gave it to a man named George Livermore, who was from Massachusetts. He had written a history of the blacks in the American Revolution, and that's where Lincoln found out about Washington putting blacks into his army. And in the Emancipation Proclamation, one of the sub-clauses was Lincoln said he would accept blacks in the Union Army. And by the time the war was over, there were 200,000 black men fighting for black freedom. So the link between these two men is in some ways the most moving thing I discovered in writing this book.
All right, I want to shift gears here and talk a little bit about Northern abolitionists. How important is it to separate out the sort of pacifist, Quaker-led abolitionist movement from the more radical elements of that movement?
Very, very important and a very good distinction. I'm glad you brought it up. The Quaker-led abolitionist movement didn't blame anybody for slavery. They simply testified to their deep uneasiness about it. I have a character sketch in the book of one of the leading Quakers, and he traveled around the country telling people that he just didn't think that slavery was something that God wanted. They didn't pay much attention to him, but he went to England and he preached that over there too, and he found that in England they were willing, at least fellow Quakers were willing to listen to him. And this man, whose name was John Woolman, he died in England of smallpox. And everybody, you know, wasn't a Quaker, thought, oh, what a weirdo, you know. For instance, he wore white clothes because he wouldn't wear dyed clothes because he knew that the dyes were grown with slave labor in the West Indies. And yet, when John Woolman died, he left behind his journal. And in that journal, he preaches this whole detestation of slavery. One of my good friends wrote a biography of me, and he called it the beautiful soul of John Woolman. And it's a perfect description of that man. And this journal was reprinted again and again in the next 100 years, and it had not a little to do with inspiring a whole new generation of Britons to begin thinking about abolishing slavery in the West Indies. And they finally did it in 1834. And 1 million slaves in the West Indies were freed with no bloodshed whatsoever. And the reason they did it so well was, they agreed to pay the owners of these slaves the equivalent of $1 billion in our money. But this was another thing that Lincoln learned. From the day he became president, he was trying to sell the South, particularly the border states of the South, on the idea of accepting compensated emancipation, as it was called. And if we could get those states, like Maryland and Kentucky, to agree, then maybe we could get the states of the further down in the South to agree. This was his goal. Lincoln did not foresee or desire a civil war that killed 1 million men, that's for sure. He was as appalled by it as anybody.
So what, Tom, motivated the more radical, belligerent anti-slavery forces beyond simply a recognition that slavery was inherently cruel and inhuman?
They hated the South. You know, we've described it. Most of them came from the New England states, and they had this basic dislike of the South, as I say, which preceded slavery. And they hurled insults at the South. They called them rapists. And pretty soon they started to talk about them in religious terms, as they called them like the great beast that rose from the sea in the Book of Revelations. And they were out to destroy freedom in the North as well as in the South. And this paranoid view of the slave power led by men who had nothing on their mind but erotic pleasure. This was what they were telling people. And, of course, this totally contradicted Lincoln's approach to things. Very early in his career, Lincoln said, if you would change a man's mind, you must first convince him that you are his sincere friend. That is the drop of honey which will change his heart in your direction. And the abolitionists were incapable of doing this. They didn't see the South as their friends. They saw them as despicable human beings that they were happy to regard as enemies.
So we know, of course, that the South ultimately did secede and that the Civil War followed. I have to tell you, Tom, and perhaps this is common knowledge that just escaped me in my years as a student, but I didn't recognize how small the percentage of Southern Americans actually was that owned slaves. And I don't want to, it's not insignificant, an insignificant number of people kept in slavery, but in terms of the people who actually owned slaves and therefore had an interest directly in the slave system was a small percentage of the Confederacy.
Yes, there were only 6% of the Confederates that owned slaves. So this is one of the reasons why I think the abolitionists thought they could conquer the South very easily. But they didn't understand Thomas Jefferson's nightmare. Everybody in the South feared what would happen if these 4 million slaves were freed instantly with no way to educate them and no work for them to do. It was you could see in the minds of all of these people that they were afraid for their, not for them, not only for themselves, but for their wives and children. And again, it was that fear of a race war such as had done such a terrible thing in Santo Domingo, and it was just that's why the South was able to turn out so many men. In the book, I have a statement by the just before the Battle of Bull Run, the Southern general, his name was Beaupierre Beauregard. He issued this war cry in which he said, "Southern men, now is the time to come to the front and defend the honor of your wives and your children." And in the book, I say, here was Thomas Jefferson's nightmare converted into a Confederate war cry. And that was why so many Southerners came out and fought. They were in the grip of this nightmare. It accentuates for me the tragedy of the whole thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're going to take a question here, and then we'll get it the question down, and then we'll take our break, and then you can perhaps get an answer for us, Tom. Let's go to Tony in DeSoto. Hi, Tony.
Hello. How you doing?
Great, thank you. How are you?
All right. I have a question and a comment. The question first is, I think we romanticize the North as this innocent group, but these are the same group of people who institutionalize slavery in law. And I think sometimes when you talk about the North, it's almost as, you know, they are the savior of the slaves, but in the reality of it is they pass laws to almost institutionalize and basically make the United States basically made slavery legally. And I wanted to ask that question to him to explain that part of it. And then I want to talk about the romanticizing of George Washington and all these other people.
Well, we'll talk about that. Let me put you on hold, Tony, because we got to take a break here, and we'll come back to this in just a second. We are speaking today with historian and author Thomas Fleming, whose new book is called A Disease of the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Thomas Fleming is my guest. We're discussing his new book, A Disease of the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. And Tom, you'll remember that Tony called before the break. And before we bring him back for his question, perhaps you can address the points that he made that the conventional wisdom that the North was sort of innocent of slavery is inaccurate.
That's true. They were far from innocent. As I said earlier, some states of the North had a surprising number of slaves. In New York City, the percentage of slaves was as high as 20%, 25 sometimes in some decades. So they were not innocent by any means. And another thing that Jefferson was fond of pointing out, the New Englanders participated in the slave trade, which was, I have a chapter in the book about how what a horrible business this was, importing these black men and women in these slave ships. The way they were treated is so abominable. And they were making huge amounts of money, these slave traders from Rhode Island and Massachusetts, bringing the slaves into America. So they were by no means innocent. And Jefferson, as I say, pointed this out more than once.
Thank you for that. And Tony, back to you. You also had a point to make or a question to ask about George Washington.
Yes, George Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln. All these men, you know, had good thoughts as far as, you know, understanding slavery, but neither one of them has ever said it was directly wrong or, even to this day, have not, even the historians have not said, no one has apologized for it. it's almost like, oh, it happens, the war is done, and it's over. And we still fight to this day from the remnants of the Civil War because there's no honest conversation going on. And I'll stop there for any remaining comments.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Well, you're saying that these Washington and others never apologized for slavery?
That's what he was saying, yes.
Yeah, well, I think that we have to understand that Lincoln himself said slavery wasn't their fault. They inherited it. The first slave arrived in America in 1619, 150 years before we even had a revolution that began an independent country. And slavery was 2,000 years old when that slave reached America in 1619. It was accepted all over the world. I have in part of one book, one of the chapters, the early chapters, I describe how one of the rulers of Spain sent 100 slaves to the Pope of Rome. And the Pope said, oh, thank you very much. And he distributed them to various nobles in Rome.
Yeah.
Nobody thought there was anything wrong with it. It was America. There's a good friend that of mine has pointed this out to me. He's a historian. America was the first country in the history of the world to object to slavery in any way, shape, or form. So I think this should make us feel a little bit better about slavery. Yes, it was terrible and so forth, but I don't think anybody should be told you should have apologized for it. I understand that you would feel that maybe they ought to, but the facts of the case are that they had this, as they saw it, a terrible problem. In the chapter in the book that I call Another Thomas Jefferson Tries to Abolish Slavery in Virginia, this is about Thomas Jefferson's grandson who tried to introduce a gradual abolition proposal in the Virginia legislature. And in this chapter, I have all kinds of leading Virginians saying slavery is a curse. It's the worst thing that's ever been inflicted on the human race by God, and so forth and so forth. But they didn't know how to overcome this fear of a race war and solve it and begin to free slaves. That was the problem that they never did solve, and that's why we had the war.
So if we had somehow been able to avoid having the Civil War when it happened and to use the legal system to abolish slavery, I mean, how much longer would the men and women and children who were kept in bondage have had to wait, do you think?
Lincoln had a plan. And the week before he issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, he made a final offer of compensated emancipation to the South. And it was very well worked out. They were going to free slaves gradually in installments over the next 40 years. And by 1890, there would be no black slaves in the United States. And by doing it gradually, there would be a very good chance that blacks would be integrated into American society, which they weren't in 1860, both in the North and in the South. In the North, most people didn't think slaves should have the right blacks rather should have the right to vote. To give you an example, at the end of the Civil War, after all kinds of casualties and so forth, the state of Connecticut voted as to whether the blacks should have the vote, and the whites said no. There was this unspoken fear that Lincoln was trying to overcome by doing it gradually, and I think we have to remember him as not only the great emancipator who helped to win this terrible war, but also as a man who yearned to win the war, to end slavery without the bloodshed that we became so involved with, because he saw other countries had done it, and this was, I think, part of the heartbreak that Lincoln felt.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak with Rich in Fort Worth. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Yeah, I have a simple question. I'm just wondering, to what extent was the Bible used to justify slavery?
Oh, quite a lot, in the South particularly. And it was justified, no doubt about it. The patriarchs, Abraham, and they all owned slaves. There was nothing wrong with it. And I came across this anecdote when John Brown was captured at the Harper's Ferry. This Catholic priest came to visit him, and he said, "Why did you do this? Why were you trying to start this terrible war?" Brown said, "It's in the Bible. The Bible is against slavery." And the priest, who knew his Bible quite well, said, "I'm really sorry, but you're wrong. St. Paul said slaves should obey their masters." And he quoted two or three other things in the Bible, which made it clear that the Bible saw nothing wrong with slaves. And John Brown then rose up on his cot where he was lying and said, "If that's what the Bible says, then they ought to burn it." So you get the idea. You're dealing with a total fanatic there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Harvey on the line now in Josephine. Hi, Harvey.
How are you doing, Chris?
Great, thank you.
Two questions, comments. The one on the Bible thing, you know, if we look at the Texas letter of secession from the Union, you know, the whole position was on slavery and that it was divine design, that freedom in the United States was built and designed for the white race, and that it was divine design for the black race to be their slaves. But the thing that I've always been surprised about is how people haven't talked about how the South had been like the world's, or the first really great Ponzi scheme. In fact, the only way it could work would be if it kept expanding. And whenever the North started putting restrictions on where they could expand to, then it sort of self-destructed.
And could I explain that, too?
Yeah, talk about that, Tom.
You're talking about, I didn't get this gentleman's name, you're talking about diffusion. This was an idea that James Madison, the father of the Constitution, proposed as the answer to slavery. Diffusion, what Madison meant was, if you could reduce the number of slaves in a particular southern state, they would be much more inclined to discuss gradual emancipation. But once the North decided they would not allow anybody to bring slaves into Kansas or any other state in the Western Territories, and they sent men out there with guns, John Brown being one of them, once they started that policy, that was another reason why the South said, we're just going to have to get away from these people. They're not our friends. They're our enemies. And it wasn't a Ponzi scheme. It was a desire to solve slavery without bloodshed and also to protect the people who in the counties of the South. John Brown, for instance, he had maps of all the counties of the South, and the counties where slaves, where blacks outnumbered whites, were carefully marked. And those were the counties he was going to attack with the slave army he hoped to arm with the guns from Harper's Ferry. It's chilling to think of what could have happened. And that is one of the reasons why the South fought so hard.
I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago, which is that you referred to this plan that Lincoln had to gradually emancipate the slaves so that it would take sort of 40 years. What leads you to believe that the achievement of full equal rights for formerly enslaved and black Americans would have been a smoother process that way than it was? I mean, we still struggle with this in this country today.
Well, it wasn't a smooth process. All we can say is we don't really know how smooth or unsmooth it would be, would have been. It wouldn't have been easy. I have no doubt about that. But we do know that as a result of the war, the blacks were forced into a horrible way of life in the South, segregated, lynched, terrorized, et cetera, all because of this continuing dread of this Thomas Jefferson's nightmare. Whereas if if gradually, you know, 30% of blacks could be integrated and move, and some of them would migrate to southern, to western states and so forth. If it had been done gradually, without any, the fear of a race war would have gradually disappeared. They would have realized, these people don't want to kill us. They just want to enjoy the riches of America, the pleasures, the opportunities of America, and which is the case. That's what we since blacks have achieved a reasonable amount of equality and the freedom to move around the country and so forth, we haven't had any race war. That's why I call it a disease in the public mind, this dread of a race war. So I do think that the alternative that we wound up with, which was hatred between blacks and whites in the South, is infinitely worse than what we might have wound up with Lincoln's gradual emancipation.
All right, let's go now to Arthur in Keene very quickly. Hi, Arthur.
Hi. My question has to do with something that your guest said.
Mm-hmm.
That was that Americans were the first to object to slavery. I always thought that was Britain that sort of ended the sought to end global slavery in their colonies and so on.
Yes. And I'm talking about objecting to slavery back in the early 1700s. John Woolman was out there objecting to slavery in 1750, and nobody in England was objecting to it. They were making so much money out of the slave trade that the city of Liverpool, which was the headquarters for the slave trade, they put a black man in chains on their city seal. How do you like that for inhumanity? Another reason why the British sometimes claim credit is there was a case called the Somerset case, where a black man who was brought to England and he had found some friends, and they sued in court saying he's in a free society now and he should be free, and the judge found in his favor. He only found in favor of that one man. There were no other blacks freed in England as a result of this. So it took 50 years of agitation to persuade the English to finally free the slaves in the West Indies. It was not an easy process, and it was a lot of insults thrown around and so forth, but it was done peacefully in the sense that there was no bloodshed, there was no warfare, and that was the great example that Lincoln thought America should follow, and he really tried to get them to do it.
The new book by historian and author Thomas Fleming is called A Disease of the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Tom, it's been very interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
I enjoyed it completely, and I must say I thought your questioners were very, very intelligent and also very patient, willing to put up with my long answers.
Well, we have a great audience. Thank you so much.
Today's show
was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And, of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can send those to us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.